Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for tuning in. It's great to have you here. My name is Henrik. This is Red Ice TV. And today we have Andrew Torba with us on the show. He is the he's behind Gab, the social network, Gab.ai, of course, and the preeminent, I would say, free speech platform that has arisen after the heavy censorship and the incredible speech restrictions, not only on Twitter, but also on Facebook and multiple of these mainstream media platforms. So Gab has developed into a really important platform for free speech. And of course, a lot of people have, you know, migrated over to that particular platform for that reason. Andrew and I think some of his teammates as well have kind of decided to, shield some of the individuals that the establishment doesn't like. And therefore, he has actually received quite a bit of criticism for that. So I'm looking forward to talking more about that. But also, actually, the main reason we have Andrew with us today is to discuss his entry into the ICO business, the initial coin offerings. This is, of course, the blockchain crypto currencies field, if you will, and they're looking at expanding Gab into that space. So that's kind of interesting as well. So, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate your time.
Oh, the same to you. Thank you so much. So let's cover some of the bases in the beginning. For those who don't know about Gab, tell us about how you started that, what the reasoning was, and just how you got into social media. Creating a social media network?
Sure. So I've been building technology startups since I'm 19 years old. And my last company was an ad tech company. And I was actually working directly with Facebook, Twitter, and Google, building on top of their ad networks. I got into Y Combinator, which is one of the more prestigious Silicon Valley technology accelerators in winter of 2015. And, you know, you instantly become a part of the inner circle of the inner circle of the elite of Silicon Valley. So I got to experience that. And that was part of my dream growing up, right? Like being a small town kid from Scranton, Pennsylvania, I always wanted to be out in Silicon Valley. I always wanted to be a technology entrepreneur. So, you know, being able to move to San Francisco and live out this dream was amazing and was incredible. But it was also very eye-opening to me. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. So I ended up befriending a lot of folks in the process of running this company inside of Facebook, inside of Twitter, inside of Google. And during the probably early 2015 is when, you know, they started to let me know about some of the stuff that was going on behind the scenes. And these folks are patriots. A lot of them are still working there. A lot of them, you know, support the President Trump or, you know, just don't support what's happening inside of these companies. And unfortunately, you know, they have to keep their mouths shut, which is it's terrible and it's sad, but it's the reality of the situation. Because if you open your mouth and you let folks know that you support the president or that you support freedom of speech for everyone or basic liberties that we all know and love here in the United States of America, you're immediately blacklisted and you may not be able to find another job in the technology industry, which is really sad. But I saw a lot of this stuff going on. And one of the bigger tipping points for me was, I believe, in May of 2016, when a whistleblower came forward and said, yeah, we're actively suppressing conservative news, conservative, you know, individuals and you know, topics from Facebook's Trending Topics product, which is a product that is used by over a billion people each and every month and what a lot of people see as news. So that really was just, you know, shocking to me. And I said, somebody has to build an alternative. Like, why is there no alternative to this, you know, oligopoly of four or five companies that own and control every means of information, communication, and interaction on the internet? The internet is not supposed to be this consolidated in the hands of a few companies. There need to be more alternatives for people who have these shared values of liberty and free expression for everybody to connect and to interact and to communicate and to get information. So that was really the, I guess, the starting point of the seed of Gab. And we ended up hacking together, a beta version of Gab in about 2 or 3 weeks and ended up launching an invite-only beta in mid-August of 2016, right in the heat of the election. And instantly, it just took off. You know, we had tens of thousands of people signing up overnight, and we actually had to prevent people from signing up because the demand was so high that our backend infrastructure wasn't built out enough to handle the amount of demand that we had. So for many months, we had an actual waiting list where you had to get an invite in order to actually create an account, which actually worked out really well from a marketing perspective. It was exclusivity marketing. People wanted to get in, but they really couldn't. And, you know, they heard a lot about us, but they couldn't get in and they had to wait. And in an instantaneous on-demand world, telling people that they have to wait for something actually makes them more intrigued and makes them want to get in even more. So that, I guess, would be the early stages of the inception of Gab back in 2016.
Yeah, absolutely. Really important. So here's an article, obviously, out of Huffington Post, and I've seen this these kinds of stuff around, right, that they have kind of pinned you guys to being the official social media platform for the alt-right. Now, is the platform ideologically driven at all, or is this just kind of more bunk from the mainstream that they're trying to, I guess, go after you guys because you actually allow some of the people, not only within the alt-right, but other, you know, kind of political extremes to actually exist on your platform as opposed to what Twitter and Facebook has done, where they boot everyone off that they don't like?
Right, absolutely. So from day one, we've said all are welcome. This is about the freedom of speech. This is about the freedom of expression. This is about individual liberty. This is about protecting the free flow of information on the internet for generations to come. And that has been our mission. That has been our stance from the moment that we launched. And you know, from the moment that we launched, we had the mainstream media attacking us and painting us as something that we're not. I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that here's the reality. When these folks in, say, the alt-right or, you know, dissidents from all over the world are being completely blacklisted and no platform from the rest of the internet, and there's a platform like ours that says, we welcome everybody, we don't care about your political views, just don't break the law. You know, of course they're going to come to our site, right? Like they're being completely shut up everywhere else. So there's nowhere else for them to go. So I think, you know, from, I think it was like 3 or 4 weeks after we launched it to beta, we had Wired wrote a hit piece and called us the platform for the alt-right. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many times we say it, they want to paint us as something that we're not simply because we have folks on the platform. Well, you know, my response to that is always, well, is Twitter the platform of ISIS because ISIS is on Twitter?
Right.
Is Twitter the platform of pedophiles because pedophiles are on Twitter? Like, no, Twitter's a content neutral platform that welcomes almost anyone as long as you now follow their very subjective and arbitrary rules. You know, we tried to be transparent with our guidelines, and it's basically follow the law. And in terms of enforcement, you know, we've enforced them both on folks on the right, the center, the left. You know, if you're not following the guidelines, and by the way, they're very simple. It's common sense stuff. It's don't break the law, don't dox people, no revenge porn or obviously child pornography, exchanging of narcotics and things that are just common sense. But if you have political opinions, politically incorrect opinions, like we don't care about that. You know, you can come on as a communist and start preaching communism, or you can come on as someone on the alt-right and start preaching your beliefs on that side of things. We don't care. We're neutral as a company on your political ideology and on your political beliefs.
Would you say, though, that it has developed kind of a niche for the more of the right and the conservatives? Because those are the ones that have been censored. In other words,
sure.
It's the mainstream platforms that have kind of forced them to go somewhere else, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would definitely admit that we have a majority of our base is folks on the right that are Trump supporters, conservatives, libertarians, even disillusioned, you know, classical liberals and centrists who don't support what is going on these other platforms. They might find some of the views that they see abhorrent or you know, maybe they don't want to see them, but our whole point is giving the users the individual liberty to shape and mold their own experience on Gab. So, you know, we had the ability to mute different words and users before Twitter even had this functionality. That's one thing that they ended up taking from us was the ability to mute different words and phrases and hashtags that you don't want to see. And then they're not going to show up in your experience because, you know, a lot of these things, Twitter says hate speech or harassment. Well, you know, something that might be hateful to you might not be to me. And something that you might see as harassment might not be harassment to me. It might just be basic trolling or somebody being a jerk or comedy or something that I can personally brush off. But somebody else might be really offended or really hurt by that. And, you know, we're not going to take a stance on that type of stuff as a platform because it's 100% subjective. And it's a slippery slope, which is what you see Twitter getting into, where they have, you know, 100% they have bias because they're located in San Francisco, which is a liberally biased city, and the majority of their employees are liberally biased. And we see, you know, Project Veritas, James O'Keefe's, you know, operation exposed Twitter engineers and policy people on camera admitting that they actually do suppress Trump supporters, and they have AI that profiles quote-unquote rednecks and deplatforms them from threads and shadow bans them and all this ridiculous stuff. And that's the slippery slope that we don't want to get into. We'd rather give you the tools to shape your own experience so that we don't have to shape that experience for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's really important. And guys, for those who are wondering, I'm on there. Lana's on there. Of course, we're going to try to get a Red Ice account. That's very important. We've seen things on Twitter. Let me just show you one example, which I encountered today, which is just, you know, it's, I mean, there are hundreds of these, but this was funny. Defend Europa, they have a rune symbol, right? And the profile image, therefore, violated their terms of agreement. So they they had to remove it, you know, silly things like this, you know, and you, because you never see, if they did extend it, you know, in truth and in reality of what it actually means, right? They would kind of do the same restriction on any religion that had, let's say, bloodshed behind it or murder or anything like that. And you could argue that you would do that to any a crescent moon and a star or a Star of David, not just these other symbols that they associate. So this is the kind of hypocrisy that you see from Twitter. And Andrew, let's talk a bit about what has developed with this, with the verification debacle most recently with Twitter, where apparently it went from basically just having a verification tick where you know that the person you're watching, you know, the profile belongs to the actual person, went from that going over to somehow being an endorsement by the Twitter company of the person and their views. Well, I mean, they seem mid-air just to change their ways. It's a not really good business strategy they have.
Yeah, that's probably one of the stupidest things that Twitter's done over the past 6 months or so is changing their policy on verification from, like you said, which is what our policy is. It's this person is who they say they are. You know, I'm Andrew Torba, and Twitter as a company or Gab as a company has verified that I am this person and that is my real identity or the identity of my organization, for example. And what they've done now is they've removed that meaning behind verification and they've now made it an endorsement. So if you're verified on Twitter, it means that the company endorses what you're doing because they are arbitrarily stripping verification from people that they did verify and confirm this is who they say they are. And they're also refusing to verify you know, certain dissidents like Julian Assange, for example, or James O'Keefe, for example. And you know, these accounts have hundreds of thousands of followers and people know that it's them. And they have plenty of people that are trying to intimidate them or pretend to be them. And Twitter refuses to you know, verify these accounts. So they have de facto made the blue checkmark an endorsement, which for a long time, I mean, a lot of people just assumed that it was an endorsement. And you wouldn't believe the psychological impact. I see this stuff firsthand on a day-to-day basis by what people try to do just to get verified, to have that sense of confirmation or that sense of status with that blue pixel next to their name. So that, I think it's really impacted society in a negative way. And I think it was a very poor business decision from Twitter. But here's the reality. People who are verified also have a higher weight in terms of showing up in search results, in terms of showing up in threads, reply threads. So I think that's another part of it as well, is they're trying to suppress certain points of view from showing up higher in search, from showing up higher in reply threads. And I think that was a big part of it as well.
Yeah, definitely. Tell us about the logo. So was there a Pepe connection or was this incidental?
So it was actually incidental. This our logo was created prior to the whole Pepe fiasco, prior to the Clinton campaign and the ADL coming out and claiming that cartoon frogs are hate symbols.
Yeah.
So I'm a Christian. And my thinking behind this was Exodus 8 from the Bible, which talks about the plague of frogs. And my thinking behind this was we're going to release the frogs on Silicon Valley and expose what they're doing to censor and suppress news and information, expose their double standards, expose their hypocrisy, expose their bias towards conservatives, towards Trump supporters, towards folks on the right. So that was the whole thinking behind it. And not only that, I mean, a frog represents fertility. It represents rebirth. There's a lot of ancient symbolic meaning behind frogs.
And beyond that, Pepe is not a hate symbol. It's a cartoon frog. It's a meme that's been around since, I think, 2007, 2008. And just because the ADL or the Clinton campaign says that something is a hate symbol doesn't mean that it de facto is. So I think that was a big part of the hypocrisy and the double standards of the media, of not even giving us a chance to explain, like, hey, this is what this actually means. And you're trying to associate and claim that all cartoon frogs are the same. It's just, it's randophobic, actually, which is a fear of frogs.
Right. It's funny. Yeah, I mean, it has, it's kind of a cliche saying it, but it has really turned into kind of a witch hunt where every little associated symbol or mark or whatever it happens to be is lambasted, and they attack people. They charge them with these things, whether they actually are it or not. They don't even give them an opportunity to actually explain themselves, defend themselves, whatever, you know, their beliefs happen to be. Doesn't matter. This is about a tracking down, hunting down people that have the wrong opinions and charging them on the kind of the media environment, if you will, burning them on the stake of the social scene, so to speak. But what about the issues with staying online? I mean, we saw a number of things back in 2017 in terms of like the going after actually the domain names and stuff like that. There were certain things that started to happen which hadn't happened before. And obviously, everyone knows Daily Stormer is one of the first ones that was hit by this. What kind of issues has Gab had in this vein? And if not the domain issue, what other areas have you been suffering from?
Oh, we've had plenty of issues, especially with app stores. So Apple refuses to allow us on their app store. They claim that we have objectionable content. They won't clearly define what objectionable content actually is. Objectionable content is found in much higher volumes on Twitter, Facebook, Reddit, everywhere on the internet. And of course, if you go looking for said objectionable content, you're going to find it. If you run a search on Twitter for an objectionable term, you're going to find things that come up with that objectionable content. So Apple, that was really one of the first roadblocks for us. We ended up getting on the Google Play Store, but then they actually removed our app from the Google Play Store because they claimed that it had hate speech on it. Now, once again, hate speech is 100% protected speech. The Supreme Court ruled last year unanimously that hate speech is free speech, and it always will be, and that's not going to change. And secondly, once again, just like the Apple case, there is hate speech all over the internet, especially against white people, against Christians, against men, in very high volumes on Twitter, on Facebook, on Reddit. That type of hate speech seems to be allowed by Apple and by Google and by these other big tech companies. But the second that you do any sort of criticism, valid criticism, the second that you cite any real scientific data, any real scientific facts about any other race, religion, or anything else that they deem inappropriate, that all of a sudden counts as hate speech. So that was, I guess, the second level there. The third level, in terms of unprecedented, you talk about domain name providers. That you brought up the Daily Stormer. Google effectively stole their domain from out from under them. They've been through, I believe, about 14 different domains that have seized and or shut down service, which is unprecedented in the history of the internet. I've never seen anything like it. They had Cloudflare refuse to give them service, which was unprecedented, had never happened before. Cloudflare, was one of the very few companies that did stand by the freedom of speech, even for ISIS websites and things of this nature, providing service for them. And we went through a very similar thing. So one day I woke up and we had our domain name service provider, DNS, reach out to us and say, you have to censor or remove this one individual post by this one individual user. And ironically or not so ironically, it was actually a post from Anglin. And it was an edgy meme, right? It was something that a lot of people may would have found distasteful or wouldn't want to see, for example. And it was a meme about the woman who was killed in Charlottesville. And it did show her, I guess, getting hit by the car, by the vehicle at the time of impact. So that is something that on our end, we would want to see it marked as not safe for work. So we have a not safe for work feature that people can mark content as not safe for work if it's grotesque content or pornographic content or something that you would deem that people wouldn't want to see, you know, when their boss looking over their shoulder, just because a lot of people do browse Gab at work, and that's not something that they want, you know, their boss to oversee or a coworker oversee walking by. So I wouldn't have asked Anglin to, you know, remove the post. We wouldn't have deleted it, but I would have asked him to mark it as not safe for work. So that was my initial approach. It's like, okay, let's ask him to, you know, hey, this is breaking our guidelines. You know, it should be marked not safe for work. Can you please do something about this? And the community just went wild. You know, they thought that we were trying to censor him and all this stuff. And I was like, guys, wait a minute. Like, first of all, it is breaking our guidelines. It should be marked not safe for work. That's point one. But point two, there's more to the story here, and let me share this with you. So our DNS, like, specifically included the hyperlink to that individual post and said, you need to take this down or we're going to seize your domain. Mm-hmm. So, you know, once we told the community this, and once we told Anglin this, he's like, okay, you know, I'll remove it. Like, I don't want you guys to lose your domain because, right, exactly, you know, it's one post or the entire website for everybody, right? So, yeah. You know, we came to,
take one for the team, man, right?
Right, exactly. But that was a big thing. Like, yeah, the press picked up on that. The community just went wild and all this stuff. But I learned a big lesson there. Like, I should have been more upfront with the community, and I should have told them, you know, right up front, like, hey, this is our DNS that this is doing this. Like, I don't want to be doing this right now, even though, like, I believe it personally should have been marked not safe for work. But I think I learned a very important lesson there that, you know, you have to be transparent with your community members, and you have to be really upfront and honest with them at all times. That's one of the strong points that we have in our community is people will call us out. You know, if I'm doing something wrong, if somebody on our team is doing something wrong, if something's not working, it's free speech, right? And that's part of free speech is calling us out and us admitting too when we're doing something wrong. And I think that's something very powerful about our community, the checks and balances of our community that help us improve and get better over time. But regardless, like, I I've never seen anything like this, a DNS coming forward and saying, like, you have to remove this one individual piece of content by a user on your website or we're going to steal and seize your domain.
That's wild.
So that was absurd. Yeah. But so I went back to them and I was like, okay, the user has, you know, removed this after that whole, you know, controversy. I said, the user has removed this, like, okay, it's fine, it's over, it's done. And they came back, like, I think it was like a week later, and they said, hey, guess what? Your site is breaking our hate speech rules. And you have, I think it was 48 hours or something to find a new domain registrar to host your domain, or we're going to seize your domain and shut you down. And I was like, so, okay, we removed the post that you asked, and now you're coming back a few days later and saying, oh, well, screw it. Even though you completely worked with us and obliged by our, you know, unprecedented request to remove an individual's piece of content, we're still going to, you know, shut you down and not allow you to host your domain on our registrar. So, you know, that was a sleepless 48 hours. But we did find a registrar that it supports us and keeps us up and running. We don't disclose right. who that is because it's a threat, and people often try to get us taken down in many different ways. We've had our hosting providers attacked. We've had our email providers attacked. And it's such a shame that people want to shut down the speech of others so much. Even though, you know, now that these people are not on Twitter, they're not on Facebook, you know, the left and people in Silicon Valley, well, if you don't like the rules of big tech, well, go build your own. And that's exactly right. What we did. And now now they're saying, well, yeah, no, you can't do that either.
No, exactly.
The hypocrisy and the double standards are insane. But so that was a big saga. That was a big part, a very big learning lesson for us. And I think our community and our team and our company emerged stronger for going through that. And what it did is it actually propelled our first funding round. So we did our seed round over the summer, and this all started happening right around that time. So after Google removed our app from the Play Store, you know, we ended up raising $500,000 within like 48 hours after that news broke. And, you know, we ended up raising the full $1,070,000, which is the maximum amount allowed for Regulation CF financing, which is under the Jobs Act. And we are the seventh company to ever do so through equity crowdfunding on the internet. So we're really proud of that. And now we're aiming to be one of the first to do a Regulation A plus ICO that's 100% compliant with regulatory standards that exist today.
Interesting. That's a part, a big part of what we're going to discuss today. Before we move into the blockchain ICO kind of area, just to underline what you kind of said earlier, you've seen the news, of course, coming up, but it, the one who painted Obama's portrait, right? I mean, this is, and this has not been censored by Twitter or YouTube. It's being, in fact, celebrated across the mainstream media, showing, you know, black women beheading white women. I mean, it's clearly racial. This is the artist that did this stuff. And I mean, this is the level of, I mean, blatant hypocrisy. We know what would happen if the roles were reversed. We know the immense world outcry that would have happened, but this is no problem. So this is just to underline kind of what you said, that we see these kinds of items popping up in the news constantly. And the point is, if they accept this kind of stuff, well, then they should accept the other kind of stuff, the other sensitive stuff. You know, I'm one who's rather, I'd rather have it all out in the open and let people express these things. And if you want, will, though, as in reference to this, show their hatred, then as opposed to kind of put a lid on it and try to cover it up and just say, it will go away. Because, again, kind of a cliche, but the fact is that, you know, if you do put the lid on, it will fester, it will get worse. If these different groups are not even allowed to, how do I put it?
Speak
and encounter each other and actually, you know, both engage in debate, but also really kind of know what the other side is thinking and stuff like that. They're going to be isolated. There's going to be more polarization. And in the end, the long run, that's going to be far worse than some people posting memes online or anything like that, right?
Well, here's the reality. First of all, those images that you just showed, that's 100% speech. You know, that's free expression.
Sure.
That's art. You know, that is 100% protected by the First Amendment. That is 100% free expression. But as you mentioned, there's a double standard and there's hypocrisy here because, as you mentioned, if the roles were reversed, if this was a white woman holding the head of a black woman and a knife, and you know, there would be so much outrage. You would probably be banned from Twitter. They would call it hate speech, all this stuff. So it's exposing the double standard. And like you said, it's much better. The best solution to hate speech or negative speech or bad speech, whatever you want to frame it as, is more speech. It's always going to be more speech. And if you don't let people express themselves with words, with images, with art, if you don't let them express their feelings that way, then the next logical thing for them to do is to move to expressing themselves through violence. And that is something that I don't think anybody wants, right? So why not allow these people to express themselves with their words, with this art, with memes, with whatever, versus them going out in the streets and you know, protesting or getting violent? You know, that's not the world that I want to live in. I would much rather deal and take on negative or hateful or whatever, again, bad speech, whatever that actually is, because that's 100% subjective, with more speech, with positive speech, with speech exposing that negative speech, like we're doing right now, versus people getting violent, because that's their next logical recourse. What other option do they have when they can't even speak their mind with words?
Yeah, it will just build up, you know, and if they're so stupid that they don't get that, then they'll learn their lesson one way or another. But let's get into cryptocurrencies, ICOs. This is a big thing that has really emerged, I think, late 2017, now going into 2018. People have called it the year of the ICOs. And again, for those who don't know, that's initial coin offering. It's tied to the cryptocurrency blockchain kind of space. And it's basically a way for, it's kind of a crowdfunding way. People can think of IPOs, initial, what does the P stand for in IPOs again?
Public.
Initial, there you go. Public. That's right. Initial public offering, which is, but the difference there, which I have appreciated with ICOs, is that it's only in the stock market, the classic stock market space, it has only been like venture capitalists and the insiders, head fund people and stuff like that have managed to get in on it. That's where the real gains are. We're talking in the thousands of percents. You know, they can buy it for super cheap, right? And then once it's actually on the market, prices go up and they can make a lot of money. Now, ICOs have been, for some people, they have become millionaires investing, you know, I don't know, $500, $1,000 way back when, you know, like in the beginning of 2017, these things had just taken off. And we did have recently, you sent them in the news as well, this being brought up actually during a hearing, actually, by U.S. regulators and lawmakers, just to kind of talk this out. SEC chiefs were debating it, talking it over. They do want to, I think they have more or less determined that this is a security, which means that it has to abide by certain rules and certain laws. But okay, so this is one issue. But before we get into that, though, Andrew, just tell us about why you wanted to go this route. What do you think the benefits are? How does the blockchain kind of play into what Gab is seeking to do?
Sure. So, you know, first of all, we've been approached by many venture capitalists in the past, and that was the path that I never wanted to take again. I took that path with my first company. I went traditional venture, traditional angel investors, Silicon Valley insiders, et cetera. And I decided with Gab, you know, our whole mission is about putting people first. And I said, why shouldn't we put people first when it comes to our financing round? So I mentioned our first funding round, which we raised over the summer. That was a regulation CF round. And we raised over $1 million directly from our users, not from hedge funds, not from venture capitalists, not from insiders, directly from people who actually use Gab on a day-to-day basis. And that is unprecedented. So that's a big part of it. And that's what we wanted to continue to do with our ICO. So we started looking into doing an ICO probably about 6 or 7 months ago. And there's really two paths. So the first path is the regulated path. And the regulated path, there's kind of two branches of the regulated path. There's regulation D and there's regulation A plus. With regulation D, it's similar to what you brought up before. It's, you know, the 1% of accredited investors or millionaires, people making over $200,000 a year, venture capitalists, you know, whales, crypto whales, for example. And that's the path. It's much less transparency in terms of regulatory compliance. Then there's regulation A, and regulation A allows anybody to invest as low as, I believe, it's $250. So, you know, the common working class man or woman can invest and actually own equity in Gab, in our case, and not have to be a millionaire or a venture capitalist in order to do so. So that's why regulation A plus was really attractive to us. And the reason that we wanted to go the ICO route, or the route of tokenizing our equity, is because it offers liquidation to our investors. It offers the ability for us to not only raise fiat or cash, but also cryptocurrencies. So we can accept Bitcoin, we can accept Ether for this funding round. And there were a lot of crypto millionaires, for example, who wanted to participate in our round over the summer, but couldn't because the majority of their wealth is stored in crypto and not in cash or fiat. So that all of those things combined were really a big part of our thinking behind this. And that's one whole path. That's kind of the regulatory path. And then those two sub paths of Reg D and Reg A plus. We're going the Reg A plus because we believe it's democratizing the process. It's allowing anyone to participate, which goes towards our mission of putting people first, and not only having the 1% or the hedge funds or the VCs be able to participate in the round. And then the other side of the coin is what 99.5% of ICOs over the past year have done, which is the unregulated path. And as you just had that article up, Chairman Clayton from the SEC said that every single ICO that he has seen is a security. and that's the reality. You know, these companies are cranking out a white paper in a weekend. They don't have a product. They don't have any users. They don't have any customers. And, you know, they're claiming that they have
an ICO, man. Who cares? It's an ICO. Can make money.
They're claiming that their token has some form of utility. And that's really their argument, is that it's a utility token. Mm. And that's what makes it not a security, is because it has some form of utility. Well, it's really difficult to argue that something has utility when you don't have a product, you don't have anybody using it, you don't have any customers. It's very, very difficult to argue that. And we looked at that path, and that is kind of the regulatory path that we're taking is the road less traveled. And it was a lot more work. It cost us $200,000 in legal, in accounting. It's required that there's a 2-year audit on your financials in order to even file with the SEC and go down this regulation A plus path. So it was definitely the road less traveled. It took a lot of our time. It took a lot of upfront initial investment. But I always argue for the people that are saying this in the ICO space, would you rather spend $200,000 going down the regulatory path today, or would you rather spend, you know, $2 million of your ICO money fighting a legal battle against the SEC when they come after you?
They might retroactively do that. You know, they might come after you afterwards. We'll see what happens. I mean, there's so many ICOs that just exploded, and there's a big worry that even people that have invested in some, that if they do backtrack and go after them, they will obviously drop in value, and people will probably bail out of many of them too. So it could be a big problem, you know?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the regulatory framework that exists today, it's not something that I think is heavy-handed. I think it's something that is there to protect investors. It's there. I mean, you look at what happened with Tezos, for example. What recourse do people who invested in Tezos have right now? Tezos is probably going to be tied up in legal chaos for the next 2 years. They have an internal founder battle between that foundation and the original founders, and it's a mess. And you know, that type of stuff is inevitable when you know, investors have no recourse for action. Those people are essentially screwed now. You know, their investment is sitting in the hands of Tezos, and there's nothing they can do about it. And you know, the SEC is likely going, you know, obviously investigating them, but is likely going to try and seize those assets and hopefully return the assets to the investors. I mean, that's the best case scenario at this point with that chaotic nutshell circus show over there. But you know, that type of stuff, if you don't have some form of regulation, it's going to happen. There needs to be some form of protection for investors. There needs to be some form of protection, you know, to prevent fraud. I saw just today there was another ICO that picked up and ran away with $4.5 million. And it's like, what do the people who invested that, like, what recourse do they have? Nothing. They can't get their money back. There's nothing they can do. There's no action that they can take. So, you know, I saw all this going on, and I, you know, beyond that, the logistics of actually doing a utility token raise, as it's called, is really a nightmare. You know, you have to set up a Cayman Islands entity and like all this shady stuff. And I was like, I was like, we're not doing that. I was like, we're not taking that path. I don't care how long it takes. I don't care if we have to do a 2-year audit. I don't care if we have to spend, you know, six figures to do this the right way. We're going to do this the right way. We're going to set an example for the rest of the world, for the crypto world, and say, listen, you know, there's a right way to do this. If you want to tokenize your equity and tokenize a security, that's fantastic. If you want to raise money in this way, which is it's a fundamental new way, it's democratizing the financing process. It's revolutionizing all of finance. That's all phenomenal stuff. But there is a right way to do this, and we're going to set an example for the crypto world and for the finance world and show them how it's done. And that was a big part of our inspiration for doing our regulatory ICO. Beyond that, I think also, you know, there's a lot of ICOs that were raising $30, $50, $100, $200 million.
It's amazing. Jeez.
On an idea, on literally an idea. Yep. And you know, here we are with Gab. We have 400,000 users. We have thousands of customers. You know, we have a brand that is recognized in the marketplace. We have real, true, concrete, tangible value in the marketplace. And we're raising.
You have a working product already. That's what you're saying. And many of these other ones don't.
Exactly. And our cap, that's why we decided to have a hard cap of 10 million on this ICO. Not something ridiculous. You know, most of them were basically unlimited, and that's why they were getting all this money. And you know, putting a hard cap on it, a modest cap on it, a realistic cap on it, so that we can build out our team, build out our infrastructure, build out our vision for the Exodus protocol, we felt was the right thing to do. Again, you know, everything that we're doing is about taking the right path. Sometimes the right path is the harder way to go. It's the road less traveled. But at the end of the day, I believe it's going to be worth it, because you see now the SEC is starting to crack down. And I believe that that's going to continue. And I think the next thing that they're going to do is start to crack down on unregulated exchanges, because that's where a lot of the fraud, a lot of the scams, a lot of the pump and dumps are going on. So what our goal here for this is essentially we're tokenizing our equity. So, you know, a GAB token is going to represent, you know, shares in GAB, Class B shares in GAB. And by tokenizing our equity, again, it allows our investors to get liquidity, because what we're going to be doing is listing our token on regulated exchanges. And there's a big difference between regulated exchanges and unregulated exchanges. Unregulated exchanges, we see them being hacked, we see money laundering going on, we see fraud, we see pump and dumps going on. Regulated exchanges have certain sets of standards and protocols that they have to follow. And we believe that that really is the future of crypto trading, is regulated exchanges. That really is going to be the next NASDAQ, the next DAO, the next Wall Street is these regulated exchanges. And the tokenization of assets, the tokenization of securities and equities, that is going to be a multi-trillion dollar market in the next decade or so. And
definitely,
we're very proud to be one of the first to be entering into that marketplace.
Yeah, there's actually tons of things here that I do want to discuss. Some of the other, competitions and many social media platforms are rising. As we said, though, the advantage that you guys have is you already have a working product and all that kind of stuff. I want to talk a bit more about the Exodus protocol and all that kind of stuff. We're going to take a break here in just a minute or two. And I want to, before we do that, obviously kind of plug how people can get involved. But let me ask you about this before we do that. The ICO, one of the advantages I see with it being, I understand the need for regulations and all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that I also did like about the Wild West kind of approach about the ICOs is that anybody could jump in. It was, in a way, it's kind of like the free speech is, right? You have to take your responsibility. You have to think before you invest. You have to think before you say something. You have to, think, is this worth it, et cetera, that kind of stuff. The downside I saw with this is that I think at this point it's like America, it's Hong Kong. There's a couple of countries and regions which have been excluded for taking part in ICOs because they do have a regulatory process. And of course, that means many other countries have had an advantage because they can get in early and actually make some money. And I've seen the advantage in that, because I like this idea also that they've taken the investment chance for people to actually get in early in the game. They don't have to be an accredited investor and this kind of stuff. And I liked that. Right. And I hope that this doesn't mean that will be shut down altogether. That you have to go through the establishment, if you will, the regulatory whole circus and the process to be an accredited investor. And only then will you, as an American or whatever region happens to be that's excluded, take part in these ICOs. So what do you think? Where do you think that is going to go? Are regular, if you will, normal people still going to be part of it, do you think? Or is this going to change the whole landscape?
No, so I actually think that what we're doing, the regulatory framework that exists today and the one that we're actually using, Regulation A Plus of the Jobs Act, allows anybody to invest in our ICO, for example. So there exists a regulatory framework today that allows companies to take this path and still allow that, get the benefit of the democratization of the process, of the crowdfinancing, of the crowdfunding process. Now, here's the problem, though. It's very costly. So in our case, it cost us $200,000 as a startup company to be able to take this path. So I think what the SEC needs to do specifically is do a combination of Regulation D and Regulation A+. So Regulation D, which I mentioned earlier, only allows accredited investors, but there's much less cost involved. So you don't have to go through the auditing process. And if you're a new startup company too, by the way, there's not much to audit, right? Like, you probably don't have that much operational data to comb through and to audit in the first place. So if the SEC creates some sort of regulatory framework that combines Regulation D and Regulation A+, and the benefits of A+ are that anybody can participate, the benefits of D are that there's much less cost involved to get it actually up and running. There's no audit. There's a lot less legal costs, et cetera, filing fees, et cetera. I think if they do a hybrid of that, I think that's ultimately going to be where the ICO space goes. And I hope that they take that approach, because it'll allow startups like us to be able to take this this approach of allowing anyone to invest without incurring that much of a massive upfront cost, which most startups cannot afford. Thankfully, we were able to because of our last round.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, exactly. All I'm saying is I hope it doesn't kind of turn the crypto space into kind of what the Wall Street space has turned into. That's my concern with it. But okay, let's just talk about this then before we take a short break. How do people get involved? Is there a whitelist you can get in on at this stage? How do people get involved if they want to invest?
Sure. So what you're looking at right now is what's called our Testing the Waters page. And for those who are familiar with ICOs, it's similar to a presale. So you can go to startengine.com/gab-select, and you'll get to this page, and you can actually actually place your reservation in our ICO before it goes live. So you see here that we have over $5 million reserved out of our goal of $10 million. And Start Engine is handling that entire process for us. And they did our last round, and we were very happy with them. And they are by far the leaders in terms of regulatory ICOs, regulatory compliant ICOs. So you can go and reserve your investment before we actually go live with the ICO. And folks who reserve will be the first to be alerted when the campaign actually goes live to be able to actually invest and get their tokens.
Excellent. So guys, we'll have a link down below. Check that out. I definitely want to check it out, read a bit more about what they're doing. I'm going to ask Andrew a bit more here in the second segment about the, you know, the Exodus protocol, how kind of how blockchain plays into it and what, you know, what benefit that has. It's changing a lot of things, the whole industry, not only of online businesses, but even offline, if you will, businesses, production and all kinds of stuff. So it's exciting. It's an interesting new kind of path, if you will, for business and production and trust also, which is so important. It's basically like a truth, a way to confirm and build trust, you know. But Andrew, thank you so much again for joining us here in the first segment. We'll just take a short break. Again, guys, check out all the links below, both to Gab, you can get in. And that's completely open now, is it? Or is it still a restriction?
Nope, it's completely open.
Okay, wonderful. So get in on the game early, folks. Check it out. Great, not only, of course, option to Twitter, but better than Twitter because they don't censor in the way that they have. This is a big problem. They're shooting themselves in the foot. Anyway, stay tuned, guys. We'll be back with the second. Thank you for watching. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to join us for the second segment of this show, the second part, please go to redicemembers.com, sign up for a membership with us. That's the best way to support us and also a way for you to check out all our content, all the shows, all the second hours. We also have Weekend Warrior. We have exclusive videos. And just tons of stuff going back to 2006 in the members section. And do know that we're updating the the members website. Since the hack, we've launched kind of a minimalist website, if you will. Some of the functions are not all in place yet, so we're looking at implementing those here in the coming month or so. So thank you for your patience on that. But it's a functioning site, and all the most important stuff is there, which is the content, of course. So do check it out. You can stream or you can download both the MP4 files or MP3 files. All of the radio shows or the interviews, of course, are primarily in MP3 format. Some of the older shows, we didn't do video back then, but most of the newer ones are available in video format as well. So you can either, you know, watch them through the player right on the site, or you can download the MP4 files if you so prefer, or the MP3 files. I know some like to do that as well. In the second segment, together with Andrew, we went deeper into the, you know, the ICO space. We talked about cryptocurrencies. We talked about blockchain technology, how that kind of fits into what he's doing with Gab. How that will aid both privacy, but also the free speech aspect. What do you do if there is content that's submitted onto the ledger or on the blockchain, if you will, that you want to censor, for example, or block, as I say, is a better word, not censor, but remove. It could be child pornography and stuff like that. He addresses that issue. And just a bunch of other things related to the cryptocurrency space and this new technology that's arising. So it's a great second segment. Please tune in, Red Ice members. .com. Thank you so much for watching or for listening. Stay tuned. We'll be right back with the second segment.